This morning, I want to talk about a text which is called Junichi Hogo. Junichi Hogo, which means on practicing throughout the day. Written by Daiichi Sochi Senji. And Daiichi Sochi Senji was a disciple of, I believe, Inin, who was a disciple of Dogen. So he, a couple of generations after Dogen. And he wrote this little text about how to practice in the monastery, but I'm codifying it to talk about how we practice in our everyday life. So I'll read some sections out of it and make some comments about that. First of all, you know, if you're so inclined, it's very nice to have an altar in your house. And so on this altar, you might have a statue of the Buddha, or you might have something that's important to you as a kind of primary object. Like, you know, here we have the Buddha as a primary figure, and then we have Kuan Yin down below. In the Zendo, in a Japanese monastery, they would have Manju, who stands for Manjushri in the Zendo. He's kind of like Manju is there as sort of the head monk in a monastic Zendo. So that would be the first thing. And you might want to have a bell on your altar. You might want to chant. You might have a copy of the Heart Sutra or something that you want to chant. You might have a space, enough space to put a zafu and a zabuton there so you could sit zazen or a chair, whatever you're comfortable in. So some place in your house that you can kind of set aside for this. So one of the things that Zen Master Zenji says here is, once you have thrown yourself into the ocean of the vows of the Buddhas, just conduct yourself with the demeanor of a Buddha and forego attachment to your own self. So this way in which we make this vow to awaken the mind of bodhicitta, we awaken our Buddha mind. In our school, we are already Buddha. We are already Buddha because the whole universe, everything is Buddha. The totality of the effort of all beings to make the world is the altruistic effort or work of the totality of the world, making the world, as Dogen would say, and that this is the demeanor of a Buddha. This is what Buddhas do. They do the continuous practice of a Buddha. So sometimes we know what that is, sometimes we don't know what that is. So even mosquitoes are engaged in the continuous practice of making the world. Mosquitoes, cockroaches, dirt, etc., whatever it is, ourselves. And sometimes it's kind of hard to get our minds around that because we have these exalted views of what Buddhas are, and so we think to ourselves, well, it couldn't be me. I can't be a Buddha. So, but in this case, he's saying, yes, he says, conduct yourself with the demeanor of a Buddha. Conduct yourself as a Buddha would. So how does a Buddha conduct themselves? They conduct themselves with this knowledge and effort and manifestation of the fact that we're part of this huge mandala of the world, making this continuous effort to create engage in beneficial actions for self and others. Others can be the environment, persons, animals, tools that you use, that you take care of the tools you use. So anything that you can think of. So once you have thrown yourself into the ocean of the vows of the Buddhas, so you've decided that, yeah, this is going to be something that I want to engage in, something that I want to put my effort into, just conduct yourself with the demeanor of a Buddha and forego attachment to your own self. So this foregoing attachment to the self is what we call no self, no inherently existing self. So it doesn't mean that you don't have a self. It means that you don't have an inherently existing self. You don't have a self that's separate from this whole activity of the world, right? And we don't. I mean, logically, we just don't, because we're in relationship. We're, if you take the oxygen that's created that we need to be able to survive, that oxygen is created by other entities, not ourselves. We create carbon dioxide. So there's this way in which that's a cycle in which we are completely interpenetrating and dependent upon the totality of all being doing what it does. So in that way, we're not separate. We're not separate in any way, even though we may feel that we are. And yet, at the same time, we are unique people and unique human beings. We have a self. We have a unique person there. We have likes and dislikes. You know, we have clothes that we like to wear, or whatever that might be. But when we say no self, forego the attachment to your own self, what we're saying is that when it is appropriate, when it needs to happen, let go. You know, Dogen says in Genjo Koan, to carry the self forward is solution. To allow myriad things to come forth and meet you is realization. So we all interact with each other. We go to work, we interact with other people, go to the grocery store, we drive our cars. When it is appropriate for us to drop our own agenda because it is for the better good, if you will, then that's the practice of no self. Every time you drive your car and you stop at a stoplight, you are practicing no self, right? You might wish you could drive through the stoplight, but you don't. You stop and you wait. You let other people go. That's the practice of no self. You don't think about it that way. You just do it automatically. But that's, you've made a vow. At some point, we decided that if we're going to drive, then we're going to follow the rules of the road for the most part. Sometimes you make a decision, no, I'm not going to follow that. You're out in the middle of the country, nothing's going on, there's a four-way stop, you have nothing. You think, oh, you know, phooey, I'm going through the four-way stop. I'm in a hurry, or I'm going to stop. So there's this way in which these rules are not like totally hard and fast, but on another level, this is a vow we make. If we talk about driving as enlightened driving, this is a vow we make. Somebody pulls in front of you when it's not their turn in our minds, and we just say, yeah, go ahead. Don't get upset. Don't get angry. Don't honk. Don't get ready to kill them. You know, no road rage. Just, okay. That's the practice of no self. That's saying, you know, really, what this situation calls for is patience, or what this situation calls for is empathy, or what this situation calls for is compassion, even though I might not feel like it at this moment. That's the practice of no self. It is not about denigrating or harming yourself through this kind of action. Okay, so that's another caveat. But this generally is the idea of what it is to practice no self. So he says, once you have thrown yourself into the ocean of the vows of the Buddhas, just conduct yourself with the demeanor of a Buddha and forego attachment to self, or practice no self. And then he says, if you spend each day and night practicing fully in accord with the Buddha ancestors for 1 year, 2 years, your whole life will be as the activities of a single day and night. So if you spend each day and night practicing fully in accord with the Buddha ancestors. So this is our effort, right? Our effort is to continue to recall the teachings as we understand them, the teachings of Buddha. As we understand them, not like we made up standards on our own, because we can do that too, right? We can like read a book or something. When I first started practicing, I wasn't practicing Soto Zen. I was practicing a kind of made up practice that I did on my own based on reading Be Here Now. So I would, you know, I thought, oh, I should wear white all the time. And renunciation was I was going to burn all my journals. Renunciation is actually stopping at the stop sign. Renunciation is those kinds of activities that you don't want to do. It's not a made up thing that you do that makes you feel really holy. Usually, real renunciation is like, damn, you know? I'm going to let go of my own agenda because I realize it's more helpful for the totality of this situation. I think that's really what renunciation is, this practice of no self. But anyway, he's saying this: the Buddhas and ancestors, so this lineage that we have, these teachings that we have over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years about how to conduct ourselves as Buddhas and ancestors. So he says, practicing fully in accord with the Buddhas and ancestors for 1 year, 2 years, your whole life, because this practice is our whole life. You know, we do exactly the same thing. Some Buddhist practices are religious practices. You know, you start out and you're doing a particular thing, and then as you get good at that, you start doing another thing, and then you do something else, and then you do something else, you know, kind of more advanced. Hey, and so does Zen. We just do the same old thing all the time. We sit Zazen, same instruction. I don't have a different Zazen instruction than you do. Same instruction. I may, maybe after years and years, I've got a maybe different response to it or a different way of relating to my Zazen than you might have if you've just started out. That's where the transformation comes. But the actual activity itself, from the outside, it looks all the same. Do service. We do the same service on Tuesday, same service on Thursday, same service on Friday. I mean, there are different services every day, but they're the same service every Tuesday, every Thursday, every Friday. And the people who come can tell you that every time they do it, it's different. But we're doing the same thing. So the practice that we're doing, there is this kind of transformation that happens through the repetition of the same thing over and over and over again. So he says, you know, if you spend each day and night practicing fully in accord with the Buddha ancestors for 1 year, 2 years, your whole life, it will be as if it were the activity of a single day and night. So a single day and night in this context, he's referring to one monastic day. So essentially, we're repeating the same practice over and over and over again, this one monastic day, this one day of our life. And I think as lay people, this one day is this vow to follow Buddha's way, this vow to follow the Buddhas and ancestors, this vow to create a kind of day in your life that continually reminds you of your practice. So this way that we do that. And so he says here, get up when you hear the sound of the morning bell and sit Zazen. So I don't know about you, but I don't have, sometimes I set the alarm, but mostly I just get up. So this way in which, and we can't all do this. Sometimes if we have kids, we can't do this. Sometimes we have a spouse who is doing something else, so we're not doing it with them. You know, sometimes we have to go to work, all the things that we have to do in our lives. But we get up in the morning, maybe we take 30 seconds to remember our vow. Maybe we have a gatha that we say in the morning, which is a little verse. Maybe we're laying in bed and we say to ourselves, you know, myriad things will come forward to meet me today. You know, I vow to practice no self. Or something like that. You can make it up. You don't have to do something official, right? So this vow that you do every morning, or just, you know, we do the rope chant in the morning. We say, you know, benefit all beings at the end of the rope chant. We wear Tathagata's teachings, the robes. We wear Tathagata's teachings to benefit all beings. So just something that you can think to yourself that is meaningful to you, that's wholesome, you know? Maybe just take a moment to say that to yourself when you get up in the morning. And if you have time, maybe you have time to actually sit. Paula Rye's book, Bringing Zen Home, there's a woman in the book and she says, every morning, she has an altar in the hallway, and this is in Japan, there's an altar in the hallway, and they have the Heart Sutra, and she would, like, before all of her kids went to school, she would make them recite the Heart Sutra. So they would, like, be ready to shoot out the door. And she's like, nope, stop. We're all reciting the Heart Sutra. So she would light incense and hit a bell, and everybody would recite the Heart Sutra. So that was something that a ritual, she said, you know, and she said as I got older and older, you know, they were kind of less and less interested in this, but at the same time, it's like, that's what we were doing. We were going to do that. So she had the sense, you know, it's something she wanted to do for herself, but also the sense that, that it was efficacious for her kids, you know, that it actually seeped in some deep level. Because that's what these practices do. They seep into our body and mind in a really deep level. We're doing the same thing all the time. We have this ritual in a way, this routine that we're engaged in, this formal routine that we engage in. Somehow that permeates us and it becomes part of the rest of our lives. Dogen says it's something that you swallow up and you spit out, right? This way that you swallow this up and it becomes part of you, and then it comes back out again in each moment, in each step. So this is, this whole life is this single day and night of vow, this single day and night. This is what we're engaged in. You can also think of the single day and night as, sometimes we think that our karma, or we think the things that we do, pile up on us, you know? Like we have no free will in a certain way. We're like caught in some way that of our kind of karmic problems. But actually, if we can stay present in this moment right now, what's happening right now, that's where our freedom comes. So we may be caught, but on the other hand, we may wake up to being caught. And when we wake up to being caught, that's that moment when we can do something different. So if we're driving our car, for example, and we're always caught in impatience, or we're always caught in feeling oppressed or angry about other people being around, you may not have this problem, but sometimes I do. So this way that we're, you know, what? You have to use your imagination and apply this to your situation, okay? You don't sit here and say to yourself, well, that's not my problem, okay, forget it. You know, say to yourself, okay, well, maybe that's Shinshu's problem, but what's mine, right? What's my problem? So whatever your problem is, usually what we do is we start out and we just do it. We don't even think about it. We just do it. And then we start realizing that we're suffering. Can feel it in our bodies, you know. And we start realizing, oh, man, this doesn't feel very good. But that part of you is like, I don't want to change. I don't want to change. I don't care if it doesn't feel good. I'm right. You know, I'm going to do this because, you know, that part of ourselves. And then you start to realize that, you know, actually it feels kind of yucky and maybe I want to make the effort to change. That's when then, you know, all of this is hard practice. And you say, okay, now I'm going to change. Now I'm going to, you know, turn on my blinker every time I go somewhere, you know, go turn a corner or whatever. And, well, so it doesn't matter because I forget. You know, I'm getting old and, you know, it's like it's hard to remember to turn on my blinker and stuff like that. And it's like, really? Give me a break. Just turn on your blinker, you know. It's like, it's a really simple thing. So this way that sometimes we just need to be a little strict with ourselves. And then there are other things. I mean, this is kind of an easy example. There are other things that are much, much harder that we do. Much harder, that our transformation. And so we can't transform just by saying to ourselves, okay, I'm not going to do that. But that's that process of waking up to it, paying attention to it over and over and over again, not beating ourselves up. We don't need to beat ourselves up. But just the knowledge in each moment is that opportunity. Each moment is that possibility of something different happening. Right? So that's that way in which this, understanding this way of saying the activity of a single day and night, is that they don't pile up on top of you. You know, even if you feel like you're under a mountain of piled up stuff. There was this movie, I can't remember the name of it right now. It had this kind of fantastic dragon in it and all this. And anyway, there was a scene where this woman who had all this baggage on her body, she had so much baggage on her body that you could not see her because she was dragging around so many suitcases and all this stuff, like completely filling her. That's sometimes how it feels, right? Our karma, our neuroses, or however you want to talk about that. You know, it's like, man, I've been hauling this trunk around for my whole life. I didn't even know I had this trunk. No wheels on it. You know, I'm just like, and then someday we wake up and they go, wow, I just realized I'm like, I'm just flattened underneath this, all this baggage that I'm carrying around. So it's a process of waking up. But once we start to wake up, at that point, there's like this little place in there, that little crack, you know, that little space that starts to open up. And as it opens up, we're freer and freer and freer. So he says, then he says, after you've gotten up, he says, have breakfast. Okay. The next step is have breakfast. He says, at this point, give up the mind of Zazen. So, because we're talking about a monastic environment, right? In this point, he's saying, forget about everything else that came there. Forget about, if you're eating breakfast, just don't pay attention to the rest of it. Whatever's going through your head. You know, you're just eating breakfast. He says, concentrate on eating breakfast. Tasting the six flavors. So the six flavors are bitter, sour, sweet, spicy, salty, and simple. So you concentrate on eating your food, right? Pay attention to what you're doing in this moment. That can be tough sometimes, especially if you've got kids. Mom, where's the mommy? You know, so it's like, what am I concentrating on? Well, at that moment, you're concentrating on mommy. So maybe you don't get that super special time, you know, when you just get to, oh, I am eating, I am chewing, yes, oh, I'm tasting, yeah, you know. Well, maybe in Zen it's like, no, it doesn't work that way. So in Zen it's like you're kind of like super speed. Oh, got to pay attention to this, pay attention to this, pay attention to this. But if you have the time, just pay attention to this. Just pay attention to this. So he says, concentrate on eating your breakfast, tasting the six flavors, and doing a little chant, being grateful, having gratitude for this meal. In our chant, basically what we're doing is we're thanking all beings for the offering of their labor and life, which sustains us, right? So this way of saying thank you to all beings for the labor that brought me this morning muffin, you know, and the death, right? The sacrifice that brought me this morning muffin. Because if the muffin's made out of wheat, that stalk of wheat had to die for you to eat it. If the muffin's got raisins in it, the raisins had to die. They were going to die anyway. But, you know, if we're eating bacon, that poor little pig had to go. So this way in which we acknowledge the fact that we are being sustained, and it doesn't have to be a morbid thing. It's just a recognition that we are being sustained and supported by the activity and the totality of the whole world. And that includes life and death. And by the way, when we die, if we're buried in the ground and we're not in some kind of lead coffin that is hermetically sealed, our bodies become food for something else, right? Our bodies decompose and transform the world as well and become part of that system of transformation. If our bodies are burned, the same thing happens. So there's this way in which, you know, we're at the top of the food chain for the most part, but we still are part of this whole process. This whole process. Our body is living and dying moment after moment after moment. So this acknowledgement that other people, other beings made effort. Other people, other, hopefully not other people, but other beings, you know, have given up their lives in a sense so that we can eat. So, but not in, again, not in a morbid way, but a way in which we just bring forth our gratitude for this, you know. And in our culture, we don't usually see animals get slaughtered so we can eat them. I think that was something, you know, when people live in a rural culture and they have chicken for dinner, somebody went out there and wrung the chicken's neck and plucked it and all of that. I remember when my relatives grew up in South Carolina and they went out squirrel hunting one day and brought back some squirrels and they were going to have them for dinner, and I saw that squirrel getting skinned and I said, I'm not eating it. Yeah. It was like 10 or 11 or something. It's like, uh-uh, I'm not eating that. You know, but we do, you know, we do eat bacon and things like that. Maybe some of you are vegetarians, but I eat bacon, you know, and it's like, I'm like thinking, okay, acknowledge that, you know, acknowledge that, that that's happening. But even if you're eating vegetables, somebody, some carrot still had to die. So what, you know, is something more valuable than something else? Maybe I shouldn't get into that debate. So I'll skip that. That's all I'm saying on that subject. But this way that we have gratitude for the meal that has come to us. When you have breakfast, just attend fully to the food with both body and mind, and do not be concerned with zazen or any other activities. This is called, so this is a phrase in Japanese, this is called clarifying the time of gruel and realizing the mind of gruel. Okay? So this would be like clarifying the time of food and realizing the mind of eating, the mind of food. So this way that we are actually paying attention to what we're doing in this moment, paying attention to the mind of gruel, you know, and not being thinking about something else, you know. Sometimes people say, well, you shouldn't read while you eat or do anything else, watch TV or anything, just eat. And that's an interesting practice, actually, because I don't know about you, but I have a tendency to want to read while I'm usually eating lunch. At dinner, Jaco and I eat together, so we just do that. But oftentimes at lunch or something, I'm like, you know, watching breakfast, watching the Tour de France before I come over here, you know, right now. So this way in which we just stop, you know, just stop and really engage in that activity just itself. And that's one of the things about coming to the Zendo. When we're doing service, we're just doing service. When we're doing Zazen, we're just doing Zazen. When we're Gassho-ing, we're just Gassho-ing. When we're doing whatever the activity is, when we're doing Kinhin, walking meditation, we're just doing Kinhin. And so that's what we're paying attention to. He says, at this very time, you have a pure realization of the mind of Buddha ancestors. So he's saying this kind of activity is the pure realization of the mind of Buddhas, this activity of just paying attention. So even we're talking about, so that's kind of a simple thing, because most of the time your food doesn't talk back, except in your own mind. But what about when it's more difficult? What if you're in a difficult conversation with somebody? What if you're at work? What if you're doing something that you don't like? You know, and so now you've got something pushing back on you, and yet at the same time, the teaching is pay attention, pay attention. Pay attention to what the other person is saying to you. Like, what are they actually saying to you as opposed to what you don't want to hear? Do you know what I mean? It's like when we don't want to hear something, we just shut down. So in some ways, we don't hear it at all. We just don't even hear what it is. So this way in which we say, okay, I'm really going to pay attention to what's going on here. What is going on in this conversation? What is going on with that other person's body language? Are they frightened? Are they angry? Am I frightened? Am I angry? Am I loving? Do I feel compassion and empathy? Do they feel compassion and empathy? What's happening here? You know, that we actually stay in that space and stay awake in that moment and pay attention to what's happening. So this is this way of paying attention to our lives, you know, to pay attention to our lives. So now he goes back to talking about the next activity here in this monastery of the Shen, and so he's talking about holding a chant book and doing the sutras. He says, the point of sutra chanting is just to hold the sutra book with both hands and to chant wholeheartedly, forgetting both zazen and meal and the meal. Do not pay attention to anything else. This is called realizing and clarifying the chanting of the sutras. So before we had realizing and clarifying the breakfast, now we're having realizing and clarifying the chanting of the sutras. So you know, if you come to morning service, we hold the chant books like this, and actually hold it straight up and down like this, so that's the form. And so partly that has to do with, in Japan, the books are like those accordion books, so if you don't hold them like this, you can end up with a, you know, with a book falling open and crashing around you. So, you know, this, we have this form like this of holding the chant books in this vertical position in front of us. So when we're chanting, you know, we're just chanting. When we're chanting, But that just chanting includes, are you chanting the same time with everybody else? Or are you a word ahead or a syllable ahead? Are you chanting in a way that you can hear the person next to you as well as yourself, so you're not chanting louder than you need to be chanting, but you're also not chanting softer? So there's this way in which that chanting is all about that mandala, the activity of doing it together. Everything we're doing is about that when we're doing service in the morning. So we're all doing our individual event, and at the same time, we're all doing this together. So it's that practice of doing it together. So driving, same thing. Giant mandala. If you could whip up above Santa Cruz County and see everybody driving, you know, you could probably see a rhythm and flow of all those cars, you know, in synchronization with each other. Or when you're at work, you know, when we're at work, we're actually engaged in this activity that's a vast mandala of the activity of the work that we're engaged in. So even if you're doing work, if you're doing work that is putting together a widget, you know, that widget goes into something that's bigger. And that bigger something hopefully is something that's helpful to the culture at large. If you're making a car, I mean, we may have doubts now about the helpfulness of cars, but let's say it's an electric car. So you're making this car, and all your job is to put that number 5 bolt into that hole. That's it, on the assembly line. And you're like going, man, this is like boring. If you don't do it right, it really makes a difference. So it's even an activity like that. Or when we go to work, we think of, you know, each one of us has our job that we're doing, but actually that job is part of a much larger picture, right? That job makes and impacts the whole culture that we're in. Or if you're in a profession where you're, like, say you're a therapist and you're having these one-on-one relationships with people, that's still part of that mandala. You know, you're still changing, still functioning within the totality of humanity and the world itself. So this way in which we're always aware of, on some level, you know, that the activity that we're engaged in is an important and helpful and wholesome activity. So we have this idea about right work practice, and that's always something to ask yourself. You know, what am I engaged in a work and an activity that's beneficial? So then he says, when you are at work, be careful not to think or speak about meaningless worldly affairs. So this is an interesting question. For me anyway, gossiping at work, right? You go to work, I mean, this was true when I worked at Cabrillo. You go to work, there's always some coworker who drives everybody else nuts, right? And so there can be a lot of conversation that harbors some ill will towards this unfortunate person, you know, or just people gossiping. So personally, you know, I don't think it's good to get into dishing other people at work. I don't think that's particularly helpful. But I also think that it's really difficult when you're at work because you're in these relationships, you know, and so you are going to talk about people's kids or things like that. There is a way in which that's how we bond with each other, right? So this always being aware of right speech and yet simultaneously not being a goody two-shoes. Do you know what I'm saying? Finding that balance in there. Because I think there's nothing more obnoxious than a person who's hyper-spiritual and it feels like they are just better than everybody else and they're going to model for everybody else how they should act. Like, yuck, you know? So I don't know what we call that person, but please don't be one of those people. So, you know, this way in which we maintain this vow that we have, we maintain this vow to follow the Buddha way, and simultaneously, that doesn't mean that we're separate. I mean, it means just the opposite. So that we say to ourselves, what is the most helpful thing to do in this situation? What is the most beneficial thing to do in this situation? So to keep that in mind. You know, in the monastery, people still gossip in the monastery, but they have a lot of silent time. So then they just go gossip behind the fence or something. Because I think as people, this is something that we, it's hard for us not to engage in. Respect your elders as you respect the Buddha, even if they are only 1 year senior to you. Even if they're 1 year senior to you. Well, you know, in our culture, I would say yes and pay attention. Because in our culture, it's not so much like, oh, you're 1 minute older than me when you say jump, I jump, you know. Yeah. But there's this way that let's just be respectful of everybody, right. You know, regardless of right. Dogen says in Rai Haitokazui, he says, you know, if I met a 7-year-old who was wiser than I was, I would become that 7-year-old student. And if I meet an 80-year-old who's wiser than I am, then I will become that 80-year-old person student. And the reality is all of us know something the rest, somebody else doesn't know. Like, all of you can teach me something about something I don't know, you know? So it's like we should always be respectful and acknowledge the fact that we have this deep gratitude for each other and that we're respectful of each other's practice and we're respectful of the effort of other people who we don't even know, right? Or somebody who doesn't agree with us politically. That we're respectful of that person, that we don't dismiss them, you know, and that we treat them with respect, even though we don't agree with what they think. Now, I'm not saying that you don't set boundaries. Okay, so that's important. If somebody's doing something unwholesome, something like that, then say something, you know, set boundaries. If you think the government is doing something that is you don't like, then go protest. You know, go do something. I personally think that doing something does not include destroying property, all that kind of stuff that people sometimes get into. But the point is that I'm trying to make is that this respect does not mean that you let people run over you. And at the same time, so I, you know, because I always feel like when I give these lectures, I'm talking over here and somebody else is thinking over here. So I want to say the over here too. But the thing about it is most of the time, it's not over here. Most of the time it's right here, which is that we cultivate this respect for self and others, that we cultivate this way in which we find a way to acknowledge that all beings are Buddha, right? Even if we don't know how that functions, even though we can't see that in this moment, that's a koan, right? It's a koan. Here you are talking to this person, and you really don't agree with them, and you say to yourself, this person is a Buddha too. What does that mean? What's the koan of that? Like, how does that inform the nature of my experience? So just think about that. Do not forget the impermanence of life and death, that you may die before you take your next breath. Conduct yourself in accordance with the Buddha Dharma. This is putting the screws to us. You know, you could get run over by a truck this afternoon. I could too. You know? I could have a massive heart attack as I sit here. I hope not. Just for your sakes. I won't care after 10 or 15 minutes. So there's this way that we don't have to be like crazy about it. We don't have to be nutty buddies about this. But this way in which we remind ourselves, yeah, I want to practice. I want to practice. It's hard. You know, some parts, things are easy for some people and hard for other people. We're all different. And you take on this hard task, you know, and it's a difficult practice. And you say, yeah, okay. I want to do this practice. I want to remember this practice. And I want to do this. Don't put it off. You know, don't delay this thing. Don't say to yourself, somebody said to me one time, yeah, I know what the right thing is to do, but I don't feel like it. Well, what that says to me is, I know what the right thing is to do, but some part of me is really resistant to doing it. So if you know what the right thing is to do and you feel resistance to doing the right thing, And you can still do it without doing yourself some kind of harm. But it's a matter of kind of,
oh, I don't want to do that.
You know, then you say, okay, but we're doing it. And then you respond, you know, you go apologize. Or you take a deep breath and actually listen to what that other person is saying. So that's the practice, right? That's the practice that we're doing. You know, you let that person in who's, you know, driving in a way that you feel like they shouldn't cut in front of you, but they do. And so you let that person in and take a deep breath and say, please, maybe there's something going on for you that I don't know about, that this is really important that this happens right now. Because we don't know. We don't know. So that practice. And then he said, be careful not to forget the matter of life and death is great and that things are impermanent and change very swiftly. You should lament having spent time wastefully in any situation whatsoever. And then I like this because then he has a little bit on here about sleeping. Says, do not think of sleeping as a trifling thing compared to zazen or sutra chanting. So we're talking about a monastic environment, and sometimes there are people who are like so gung-ho, you know, I'm only going to sleep like 45 minutes a night. I'm going to sit zazen 24/7. You know, I'm going to be completely silent and not talk for years. You know, just this whole thing that people are doing. And actually, Baba Hari Das, he did that. He didn't speak for a long, long time, but for him, it was appropriate. So all these things I say, you know, may be appropriate for somebody else. But for most of us, we need to sleep. So he says, don't think of sleeping as a trifling thing compared to zazen or sutra chanting. So sleeping is important. Taking care of your body is important. You know, getting enough exercise, sleeping, eating the right food. Take care of this vessel that allows us to practice. Take care of this body that allows you to engage in beneficial action. Take care of this mind, you know, and do not neglect yourself in that way. And he says, when you go to sleep, don't think about the Buddha Dharma, much less of things having to do with life and death. In other words, when you go to sleep, forget about all the stuff you have to do the next day or you didn't do that day. You know, don't like in your head. He says, just sleep. What a radical idea. Just sleep. Right? That goes along with the just eating. Just driving your car. Just doing gassho. Just sleep. And then the karma of life and death is exhausted and your body and mind are nothing but Buddha ancestors. So they often say this about zazen too. You know, zazen, it's like when you sit zazen, your karma is completely gone. So actually there's this way in which when we completely presence ourselves in the present moment and we are completely responding to that moment, just sleeping, just sitting zazen, just doing this, particularly activities like eating, sleeping, zazen, you're not creating karmic residue, right? Or at least if you're following the instructions, you're not. I would say if you're sitting zazen and you're saying to yourself, oh, I'm terrible. Oh, I'm bad. Oh, I'm so horrible about this. Oh, I just had another thought. Oh, I'm fantasizing. I'm a terrible person. I would say that that is creating a kind of karmic residue in your mind about, you know, yourself that's not helpful. That's why we have this, you know, the instruction is let that go. Just let that go. That kind of thinking is as much an attachment to self as aggrandizing the self. So there's this way in which, just let it go. You're just sitting there. Sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes thinking, sometimes not. Sometimes fantasizing, sometimes asleep. Just come back to the present moment and let that go. You know, do you know when you're sleeping and you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and if you start thinking about stuff, why am I up at 3 o'clock in the morning? I can't believe I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm never going to be able to get back to sleep now. You know? Oh, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, what should I do? Should I get up? Should I leave? Da, da, da. Well, sometimes we do that. It's like, okay, it's over, you know. But if we just go, oh, okay, 3 o'clock in the morning, go back to sleep. So you never know. But there's this way in which just do this activity, just do this activity. Then he finishes with, if you do not deviate from the teachings of the Buddha ancestors or your teacher, once you cease to hold yourself dear, in other words, you open up to this notion of no self, and enter the ocean of the vow of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, your body and mind will be nothing but the Buddha, flaws and all, you know, warts and all, nothing but the Buddha. The karma of birth and death, or life and death, which is samsara, is immediately exhausted. I'm not so sure about that. I read somewhere this person said something like, asked a teacher one time, they said something like, if I do this practice, it will end my suffering. And what they said is, if you do this practice, it will change your relationship to suffering. Right? So the karma of life and death or samsara may not be immediately exhausted in the sense that you think it will be exhausted, but it may be exhausted in a way that we don't quite know what that is yet, but the relationship will definitely change for the better. Okay? It is said that the Buddha practiced for many lives during immeasurable kalpas, yet it was nothing but the practice of one day and one night. So the Buddha practiced for many lives during immeasurable kalpas, yet it was nothing but the practice of one day and one night. It was nothing but this practice of just this, things as they are, staying, coming back, just this, right now, myriad things coming forward, practice realization. Therefore, this practice of gyoji, or continuous practice with all beings, with everything, making the world, is, he calls, the king of samadhi. If you really wish to become a Buddha in this present life, just practice this practice continuously. Thank you very much.